Oh great, it's another bass podcast.
So, hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Oh Great, it's another bass podcast. With us today, we have our very first guest, and what a guest to start off, you know, the guests. It's Mr. Amos Williams from Tesseract.
Hey, how you doing everybody? Thank you for being alive.
Yeah.
And thank you for joining us today.
Yeah.
It's my pleasure.
We're super excited to have you here. Amos, thank you so much for taking your time.
You're very welcome. It's very nice to speak to people who might understand my pain.
Yeah. I was talking to my colleagues. I teach music at a, you know, public, small public school
here
in Stockholm, to kids like years three to six. And I was talking to the woodshop teacher and whatnot. I was like, yeah, I'm doing an interview tomorrow with for the bass podcast. And she was like, yeah, I mean, the amount of nerdiness that you've got in you, I mean, I can't even fathom how I would be able to apply that to my craft. Like, how? So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, Amos, how have you been?
Good. It's really strange for musicians in our position because we are forever busy, but the level of the intensity of what we're doing obviously has peaks and troughs, and the last sort of 18 months have been pretty intense, but now this last sort of 6-7 weeks since announcing our new album and starting to get things out there with releases of promos and that and interviews and prepping for tour production and all manner of like behind the scenes things that you wouldn't imagine go on have been really rather intense. So the unfortunate thing is I really could do with quite a good long holiday now, but unfortunately that's not happening till this time next year, so I'm gonna have to work that one out, because it's fine when you're 20, but you know, as you become advancing in age, there's no catching up anymore. There's no. And the only time that you can relax really is when you're on stage, so that's a really interesting scenario to be in.
Yeah, it's like when you have kids, I guess.
I can imagine. Yeah. Some of the guys, well, everybody except for myself and the drummer, have a family in Tesseract, and they have all aged at such an incredible rate since they started to have children that it's funny, but at the same time, I can empathize that it must be super, super intense once you start having a family. It's quite a commitment.
Yeah, it's different, I guess. Like the thing, like coming home from a gig and just being able to sleep in like the entire day after. Mm. Like my daughter was born 2019 in December, so she's like a pandemic kid, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I had my first gig when she was close to 2 years old.
Yeah.
And like it was a two-nighter, so to speak. So like I was trying to sleep in the day after the first gig. I got home at like 3, and at 6 in the morning she was like, daddy.
Of course.
Like, oh god.
The bass is the thing that we chose in our life, hey?
Yeah.
It's going to have to just deal with the good things in life as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, incidentally, I'm actually a lawyer by day, bass player by night. Yeah, and I'm
That's
a custody
an
lawyer.
Job.
So I deal with family law, so...
Oh wow!
And I don't have any children or an extended family, so I think that actually helps me in my work. But I can't relate to Eric in that way yet.
Mm. No,
it is really interesting, though. I think. Sorry to. I think it's a very pertinent thing in modern day music, because how do musicians juggle real life with the fantasy that we try to lead?
Yeah.
And I think it's something that is not understood enough from an audience perspective.
No.
Even quite successful or seemingly successful musicians, they've really got to juggle a lot. And that's the reason why sometimes you might have 5 years between albums.
Yeah.
Or even longer in some bands' cases, because they've said, I cannot do a band and have a family. So Like, I know many musicians, they chose family, and then 15 years later, they decide to try and get it started again.
Yeah.
And it's insane just to see the level of commitment that you have. It's like having a second family, the level of commitment between the two. And I can't even fathom the sort of struggle that people must go through. And I really do feel for the members of my band that, you know, when they're looking at being away for 7 or 8 weeks, I honestly wouldn't know what to do. It seems like a really intense thing. So congratulations for gigging and having a family. That's cool, man.
Yeah, but these days, I mean, it's gotten so much easier during the like past 10 years, I guess, like with you know, FaceTime and doing things like, I mean,
this is cool.
This really helps. I mean, it's not perfect. Like in the ideal world, you would just teleport to the gig and teleport back home, but
soon we'll be there.
Sooner than later. Yeah, of course, AI will figure it out soon.
That's awesome.
I totally get what we're saying. Like, you know, all like this grind behind the scenes that no one sees.
Yeah.
Like the grind that you don't show on Instagram or, you know, in YouTube videos. It's like, because that's the hard part. That's like the true work, so to speak. So I get that you must be exhausted, right? Like already.
Yep. It's one of those strange things that it's all or nothing really when you're a touring musician. You basically, when you're off the road, there's so much that you are doing, but you're so flexible in your life. And then suddenly you're traveling the world and you're stuck to a schedule that pulls you away from everything. That being said, it sounds like I'm moaning and I'm miserable from it. Of course I'm not. I wouldn't do it otherwise. But it is a really interesting psychological question. I mean, why be a musician? Why be a touring musician? Why do these things? And quite often, it's almost like a button that you have to push.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't get pushed, something bad is going to happen, I think. Certainly for musicians at my level, it's definitely, you know, you're not driving around in Ferraris. So it's... you're doing it for another reason, I think.
Yeah. It's like an itch, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. There's a compulsion.
You just can't reach it enough. Like, you need to scratch it never properly scratched.
Oh, I just noticed you have cats on your coffee mug.
Yeah, man.
Are you a cat person?
Although I've not taken care of a cat for years because of what was the problem I would have when I'm touring. How do I look after the animal? So, it's most of the band are cat people, which is great. And then we have the strange species of human, not even human, called the drummer, that is a dog person.
Oh.
And there are just some things that we can't communicate on. You know, there are just, it's all lost in translation. So myself, Akul, the guitarist and kind of main songwriter, we're definitely cat people. And then the rest are like, cats are cool, like them.
Yeah.
But this drummer, don't know what to do, man. He's just a dog person. And might have to fire him just for that.
Is that why you have separate clicks?
Yes, this is it, man. Yeah,
different, I figured.
Different clicks, different, you know, different downbeats, because we speak very different languages.
It's funny because our mutual interest of cats is one of the things that brought me and Eric together to begin with.
It may be a bass player thing, you know, or maybe a certain type of bass player that perhaps isn't like aggressively metal. I think that, you know, our modern bass players fall into two tracks. You got people who have an interest in jazz and funk and or maybe have very different things going on in their bass world, and also maybe play more than the bass.
Yeah.
And then you've got dog-loving metal bassists. No, I'm really taking the piss there. Of course, everybody loves cats or should love cats by law.
There you have it. The debate has been settled. Cats are for funk bassists and dogs are for metal bassists.
So it shall be written.
So the classic question, Amos, how did you start playing bass?
I'm not sure I consider myself a pure bass player. I've always played lots of different instruments, and I quite often feel that I'm a percussion player when I'm playing bass. It may just be that I lean into the percussive rhythmic element of bass playing more than I do into the melodic, simply because as a child I was a orchestral percussionist and a drummer until the age of about, I'm going to say 12, something like that. And then I started playing bass and was one of the very few bass players in the whole of the school I was in. I honestly think there were three or four of us. So yeah. we were in loads of different bands. And I'm sure you had similar experiences. You know, people were singers or they're guitarists. And it seems to be that there are something about the bass doesn't naturally garner that much attention when you're younger. But for me, I was like, no, man, I really like people like Flea and Chili Peppers. If I'm listening to them, I'm not really listening to the guitar or the vocals. For me, it was exciting to listen to the bass and the drums. Yeah. So I kind of gravitated towards drums. I'll be honest, though, as a bit of an ignorant kid, or innocent, shall we say, I was listening to heavy music, and my first understanding, I mean, I'm talking about like 8-year-old, 7-year-old.
Yeah.
Listening to things like Slayer and Iron Maiden and going, oh, the distorted guitar is the bass guitar, isn't it? Which, I mean, that just shows my innocence, we'll say, as a child. Yeah. So perhaps a misunderstanding of what was happening through innocent child ears led me down the path of finding bass far more interesting than everything else when I was suddenly in that position. But I found out pretty quickly I'd made a mistake there, but I was okay. I was all right with it.
So are you classically trained as a musician? Did you study in university?
Well, in terms of percussion, yes. In terms of bass, no. I don't believe I've had more than, say, 15 lessons in bass, and it's not because I had an aptitude for it or was excellent in any way. It's just it felt like I was already on a path that I had to just kind of follow myself, which is why I might have techniques that aren't as efficient as others, or I play quite not roughly, but I do play it like it's a percussion instrument. Each instrument suffers when I'm playing, unfortunately. But also I feel that there's a tone element there, that in the same way that quite often like a rock drummer is just absolutely punishing the snare drum, I feel that that's kind of just what I've been doing with bass for a long time. I'll admit that sometimes it doesn't always, it's hard sometimes for engineers to walk into this scenario and to get it straight away, and they might ask me to change, but I think given the fact that a lot of what I do is DI based and not amp based,
yeah,
I have a bit more headroom than most when it comes to getting the sound that I need on record. And on stage without having to apply, quite often there's only a little, like a dB or two of compression, which I think is partly because I am adding such a huge dynamic range to it by playing it like a drum.
Yeah. I think you were the first bass player that I saw, you know, slapping in like modern metal, not like, okay, you know, feel like doing the feely thing, like, yeah, applying it. Because I remember seeing the live version of April that you did, yeah, in like New York years back.
Oh, wow.
And I was really like blown away by your rhythmic playing and like, cool, how it locked in with the drums as well.
Yeah.
And I think that was like the first time I really heard slap bass being applied to metal in that, yeah, way. And I mean, these days, like so many other guys are, totally, are doing it, like, yeah, especially like in more, you know, genty, if you, yeah, don't mind the word, genre, like you have, I mean, Nolly did it, and we have, Jacob Umansky. He's big, I mean, like double thumb. Yeah,
he's but on a different level, isn't he, man?
Yeah, he's
I'm gonna suffer because they're supporting us. Intervals are supporting us on tour. So for a whole 6 weeks, I'm just gonna hate myself as I see Jacob just doing his thing. And yeah, I'll feel like a right dickhead, you know. I'll just be like, well, here's me doing. I mean, you know, obviously it's not about how many notes you can play, but he's also really groovy as well, which really annoys me. It's like, cool, you're very technical and you're groovy.
And you're groovy.
This is fair.
And it's interesting because you mentioned you think your technique is rough, but what I hear when I listen to Tesseract Records is a really clean and precise bass. So that I got exactly the opposite from your playing.
Yeah, it may be that I am aware of how a teacher would destroy my approach and get me to rebuild myself, perhaps. I'm also aware that I do cause myself, not injury as such, I would say, but I can definitely feel that I could be doing it in an easier fashion.
Yeah.
But then again, as well, I did spend, you know, a good 10, 12 years developing these hands with sticks in. So I ended up coming to the bass and it was really easy to play. And then, you know, moving to guitar as well, was finding that almost impossible to not like overplay it because it just felt so much, it felt tiny, like, especially the strings. Yeah. And it felt almost impossible to get the sound I wanted out of it without feeling like I was going to break it. So perhaps because of the drum training, and not just with sticks, I was also involved in Southeast Asian gamelan, which is it's like court music where it's just percussion ensemble, and the tuned instruments, you use little mallets, but there is a drum in the middle that is essentially the conductor, that I found myself in that role quite early on. So again, maybe it's just, it is my voice, and instead of ignoring it, I chose to just continue going down that path. And it certainly is not like everybody else, and I've certainly tried to teach some people, and it's proven quite difficult because they've had to they would try to emulate what I would do, and I maybe wasn't cognizant at the time and to what the difference was, and so maybe I could have encouraged them to do something differently from that manner in that respect. But it does feel, I've always felt Tesseract is quite raw, but maybe that is because, maybe the refined element is because of the, perhaps an incorrect point of view that it is raw. And certainly myself and Ackle are constantly thinking, oh, these things are out of tune, or these things are out of time. So maybe I could understand that that is what makes us pursue a more precise, hopefully smooth sound, when in fact, you know, we are thinking it's raw, but when in fact it is smooth and maybe a bit more sharper and refined than we appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such like a musician thing to do as well. I've heard the story about Meshuggah when they were doing one of the earlier albums, and they were just like sitting, holding their face, like, oh, is it tight enough, guys? Is it tight? Just sitting there, just listening over and over to the same.
Bam, straight, like, it's tight enough. Yeah,
yeah, like the first like eight bars, like. Oh, but is it tight? Is it tight enough? Like zooming in on the track. Yeah, like, and this was before Pro Tools, like editing. So they were like, we should do it again.
But what I find interesting about your technique, Amos, is the fact that you incorporate bends at the same time as you hammer on with your thumb, and that creates kind of a tension in the music. You know, you get a tension, you get a specific feeling. Is that something you think about, or is it just something that developed from your technique?
I have looked at this actually, and I've wondered where the root of this is from. I'm thinking, and it could be very much as a result of, say, where Ackle, when he's writing a guitar part, he might not realize the pivot he's creating with his thumb, for example. Perhaps he's a little too high or a little too low. I've not actually ever stopped and looked at him and gone, are you bending this note by accident and you don't realize, and you're creating what is essentially the Tesseract sound, which is this quite precise bend at every, almost towards the end of the note, like you're creating a sustain that opens up the notes, the harmonics of the note somehow, which is really intriguing sound to me. Certainly with bass, it's something that just feels right. And again, maybe it's the influence of just being hanging out with each other. Certainly I noticed that a lot of Ackles' dead notes when he's writing guitars weren't there until we started being in a band together. And, you know, I was filling in, creating ghost notes and things like that. And then certainly the introduction of bends just before an awkward move on the bass line, or a bend and then a hammer-on onto a different string, is something that is really not that natural at all, especially when often that hammer-on is your third or fourth finger. But when you think about the shape of your hand, perhaps it's actually quite a natural thing to...
Yeah, exactly.
It's literally like you're swiveling almost on a pivot. And, I mean, again, maybe that's a case of bad technique that sounds great. So it's not bad technique, but it's something that might have been educated out of me had I gone down a more precise path of education.
It's certainly part of the Tesseract sound to me. I mean, take a song like Nocturne. It's literally built around that, you know, tension. And like, I'm going to get to that later because, but just, you know, the tension you can really hear, like, it's like Sturm und Drang, if you know the classic German Wagner. The push and the pull in the music, you know, so creating like dynamics.
What's going on there? You have rhythmic syncopation, and I guess we're talking about a form of melodic syncopation.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you're adding, for lack of a better word for understanding it in a way that could be easier for everybody to figure out, you're adding shuffle. You're adding a swing to the melody. I actually wouldn't know what that would be called from a theory.
Harmonic
standpoint.
Tension, almost, I guess.
Say again, please.
Harmonic tension, I guess you could say. Like, or suspense, or
that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, but without changing anything harmonically.
No, exactly.
So without restructuring a chord, you're creating certainly that subtle tension that's nice when it's released, which is the same as syncopation for me. I love that.
Yeah.
Almost snap, but then release. It's really cool. Yeah.
It's also, you know, the dynamics, you know, like the between the big airy sections of songs like Juno, like the big intro, and then you have this really like rhythmic, funky.
Yeah.
Would you call it riff, maybe? But it's I don't want to call it a riff because it's so much more. It's like a percussive pattern. And
it's a really interesting one there because it's very small as well. What have we got? I would almost say that really only have like two or three beats that are slightly varied in an example like that in a larger loop, obviously, of like a repetition of, say, four or five times. But it's an idea that's very small, and I think that concept came from people like Steve Vai, who would sit there and go, how do I make these amazing riffs in his wonderful tone that he does when he sits down and does a talk to people? He's going, well, I just have a little lick, and it's as simple as that. And then he's, you know, wrote the whole of Passion and Warfare in about 4 hours or whatever he was saying. But it's, it all starts with that tiny, tiny lick, and I think that also is, let's call it a lick rather than a riff. I think that's what I mean to say in that scenario.
And a fancy term, ostinato.
I was going to go with ostinato as well.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. So, I mean, you're known for having pretty much a very clean tone, like a huge clean tone. How do you achieve that kind of tone on a record and especially live?
Yeah,
it's not clean, is it?
No, it's not.
Dissect it. Yes, it's a bit like having parallel. The way that I look at overdrive is that it's actually compression, except it's affecting things on not just on a dynamic level, but a harmonic level. You're introducing so much of the top end, which helps it poke through. So what we have on most Tesseract recordings are we have a clean channel, and then we have really, I'm talking about anywhere between the lowest that an overdrive signal will come in at is 900 hertz, because it gets a bit boxy down there if you go further. Now, I appreciate that everybody else probably goes down to 160, you know, why not? But it's taking that concept and moving the goalpost up. So your crossover point is 900, sometimes 1, 2K. And then on the top side, where you've got a low pass filter, bringing that down to no more than 3K, really. Sometimes we open it up a little, but it depends on the strings during recording, because perhaps it's already there in the clean tone. We're almost after a fuzz,
a smidge.
It's almost a bit like paper. You know, it's like the rustling of paper you to think the bass is louder than it is, because you're actually hearing the bass from its like harmonic point of view, without me adding a huge amount of mud into the track that's only then going to be cut out afterwards. So perhaps it's about the efficiency of tone. And I think that's come from being in a direct situation rather than using an amp. It's even the cleanest of cleans are not clean in this scenario.
That's interesting, because sounds clean, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's it. It's so much of being in the studio is making something sound like something that it's not. You know, finding the purpose, the shelf that you put it on, and however you do that doesn't really matter. I mean, quite often there'll be a small, let's say, delay or ambient, and that also behaves in a way that makes the bass prominent in a fairly non-traditional way. And I think the reason why we started doing things like that is because there's an old trick where you actually make the bass stereo, but only the a high pass of, say, 160 up, and then that is through a little chorus, very subtle chorus, and you just bring that in subtly. That's a really old studio trick, and I think that's where we would have been coming from with the idea of, okay, if we're keeping it in mono, we're going to slightly smear those high frequencies so they're longer. And if we're going to have a stereo track, we're going to make it so it almost feels a bit 3D by having the mid again kind of smeared to the sides in this idea, rather than being just down the middle, but of course keeping subs, lows down at the bottom, because quite frankly anything beneath 400 hertz is kind of mono anyway, because your head is only so wide. So it's really interesting to apply often psychoacoustics that are things that affect you, rather than you going into the studio and saying, I'm going to trick this human into that. So it's just from the application of, well, if it affects me, it's probably going to affect other humans, which is a really interesting way of working, I think. It's nice to give an instrument more than its traditional space in the mix by adding little things that you just would not expect.
Now, a specific question, speaking to my nerdness, I remember when Smile was released as a single, and I can swear you remixed it before the album release, because the album release sounds completely different, especially in the bass.
I would say that's very likely, because the original release was because we were going on tour with Megadeth, Sugar, and Lilith, and we needed something to promote that. But it was a good 9 months ahead of the planned album.
Oh, yeah.
So I would imagine there's more than just a remix on that. I think we re-recorded some elements, maybe there's some rewriting. I don't actually remember, unfortunately, but I would suggest that, yeah, we've definitely, the remix would have been a thing for that, for sure. I would hope the album version is darker, more industrial, and a bit meaner, because that track is all about that. Again, an ostinato. Those two verses are three notes, just repeated in a Nine Inch Nails style way, for what was for us an experiment, to really, does this style work for us? And I think it does work for us, but it's not something that we're going to be able to do all the time for Tesseract, because maybe it's a one-trick pony for us. But it's really cool. On the new album, we've done the same thing, but with just one verse. And I would imagine it's the sort of thing that nobody's expecting from Tesseract, because it is essentially like Trent Reznor's come in the room in the 1980s and has gone, you know what this needs, guys? This needs some weird shit. And yeah, that's what's happened.
And that's interesting, looking because that. Something I usually discuss a lot with Eric on the podcast is, because we have quite a different approach to tones. Generally, Eric uses a lot of distortion. I want the kind of distortion, like the harmonic content, you know, like yep, if I dig literally in, I want, you know, the overtones to start singing. But I also want like a really clean bass, no pun intended. Yeah. And you know, that slight break of that harmonic content, that's all what I'm about in bass tone, because without that, a bass is just like a sinus curve. If you do just a flat like preamp straight into the mixer board, it could usually be very, very boring. And you get all those high-end elements you don't really want in the tone as well.
Yeah. I mean, in my case, I use a lot of distortion because I play usually in a, you know, three-piece setup with, you know, one guitar, bass, drums, vocalist. So you need to like fill out the sonic void. So there's that reason. But yeah, I don't know if you've seen that. There was an interview with the sound engineer for Iron Maiden, Pooch, and he's got a podcast with a sound engineer colleague of mine. His name escapes me now, but they were talking, like they had an entire episode dedicated to just bass and you know how they saturate bass on their mixing desk. Say, yeah, we and like add harmonic distortion just to, you know, bring it out in the mix. It was pretty interesting and inspiring to hear. And this, like, hearing your approach to your studio tone and everything is like, man, it really gets me going. It gets me like excited and hyped about tone dialing. So what did you use for like for the recording? Did you go like all in the box, or did you go like
analog? We tried everything. Like my pedal board at the top of it for one, I don't know, for like 2 days, we had either triple rectifier sat at the top of my pedal board, and I was going into like a 4x10 in another room, it was great, it was fun, but ultimately it wasn't Tesseract. It was not really allowing the dynamics to come through that perhaps we need. You know, it's interesting, a lot of people say, oh, bass often needs more distortion than you would imagine when it's in the mix. And for a long time, that's the way I was working with those sorts of things. And I just keep dialing it and dialing it back.
Yeah.
Again, that might come from the way that I'm playing, that I'd be constantly just really pushing this thing. And perhaps I actually was always searching for a distorted tone that was dynamic, which sounds against it's counter to the point of overdrive, maybe. But maybe it's because I'm really, I love things like Pink Floyd, and I love sounds that are warm and organic, and I'm fine with a dirty sound, but it needs to be dirty because the input is hot in my mind. So maybe that's why I was going down there. So the idea of using like triple rectifier was just overkill, man. I think I even plugged in the diesel Herbert, the diesel VH4 and again, we're just talking about like signals from 8-900 up. Yeah. And it's a cool idea, but it just wasn't working in the studio.
No.
So I believe all of that work in the studio was a mixture of, we sent a clean channel plus a transformless channel plus one that was going through an ELOP solid state, which is great, by the way. It's like a Manly solid state compressor. I think that's the only thing you can have now. The ELOP version doesn't seem to be available, which pissed me off because it's a really good unit. It's like, this compresses really nicely, only at one setting, only at one threshold, but I'm all right with that because it works for me, you know. We had that as part of the clean channel, and that was going through with a Sadowski preamp. So I was trying wherever possible to be passive on board, going into the Sadowski and adding a stupid amount of gain, like bringing it up to, say, the same level as you'd imagine with a active output, especially because all my basses for some reason are 18 volt. Which is weird because I'm essentially disengaging the preamp now. And but you know, I'm always doing that. I'm just, the journey is varied, and it's not that I'm capricious or anything. It's just that the things that I like change. So after, you know, on each album, I'll approach things differently. But yeah, so we had that, which was clean into the Sadowski, into the ELOP going to the board. And then we had another one that was going through the neural quad cortex with, I think if I remember rightly, just using their onboard factory B7K, is it? I can't remember.
B3K,
And really, I was pushing that thing, so that was quite surprising. I was getting not so much the drive, but getting a lot of gain out of that thing. Then some of the later tracks, I started to use I think it was Aguilar model on that. I actually don't have the Cortex with me at the moment. It's in storage before our next tour, but I think it was the Aguilar, which is really cool. And by the way, for touring, I've now started using the Alpha Omega head, which is really good. I think there's version 12 or 15, whatever's on the, you know, they've got different captures. It's astonishing. It just works for me. You know, it's one of those things you plug in, you're like, oh, wow.
Here we go.
This sings. So I don't need to worry about this, do I? So that was really cool to find that. But the clean for recordings, like for our first single, War of Being, that would have been in the studio. Akko would have tuned the distortion to fit the guitars. And he's using parallax for that. I mean, that plugin's great. And it would literally, there's sometimes I mess about with the mic placements and switching the one of the mics to a ribbon mic just to get a muddier sound, for lack of a better for lack of a better term. But that would have been kept at the default in terms of, I think it's just one SM57 slightly off center, just a little bit off the grill for a tiny bit of ambience, that you know, the sort of thing you only notice when you take it off. So it would have been that, and it would have been starting out with the Forrester Saville patch where the crossover's at about 160. So you're actually, what you're really doing there is taking that awful 130 sort of that appears in all bass, or at least it does to me, and kind of focusing it slightly higher than normal. So maybe around 90 hertz, I think the prominent character is 90 to 100. And then again, at 160 to 180, you get more of a, you don't have to push things so much. But then he would have scooped the hell out of that. Like the mid will be...
Disintegrated, essentially.
Totally, because I mean the guitars need dynamic range there. So it's fine. That's cool.
I remember you were with Warwick basses for a while, weren't you?
For a long time, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever try the Hellborg system, the amp system?
What do you mean, did I ever try it? I still have one here.
Because what you're describing with gain staging and, you know, transformers and everything, that's literally what the Hellborg system is.
Yeah. I used to tour with this Hellborg thing, and which is why it's sat under my desk at the moment, because I need to fix one of the op amps on it. But it's beautiful, clean thing. You know, it will not give you anything other than what you put into it, but it will give you that in a really good light. You know, it's not a massive tone shaper, I don't feel, for me anyway. And I actually feel sometimes it's quite difficult not to clip the thing. It is a really nice piece of gear. And it's a shame it's not really around anymore. But when I've got things like the Quad Cortex available, or even when with Kemper, it's safer to carry that around than it is to carry a 1U rack that, I don't even remember how much the thing was, but it's probably a few thousand if it was that really cool. And it was really cool with my FNA Jazzman that I used to run with.
But the reason I asked is because I have a Hellborg rig incoming myself. Ooh, so.
Cool, man. You're getting the power amp as well?
Yes, I'm getting a 250 mono, a 500 mono, and a high cab, and I have the big cab coming later. So I'm gonna basically destroy my apartment complex with bass.
So. Yeah.
Speaking of basses, we mentioned Warwick basses, and that's how I came to know you, through because Warwick basses were my first love. Basses, basically. I remember trying a thumb bass when I was young, and I was just blown away by the tone.
Cool, man.
And something I also discuss a lot with Eric is string spacing, because I've suffered from spider fingers, and I cut myself just before.
I understand, man.
So anything more narrow than 90 millimeters just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
What about you?
I feel you. I used to have a broad neck bolt-on thumb, where I believe it was 22 mil between, so a six, it was basically a six string neck with five strings, and the spacing, the additional spacing to was then afforded by that, and that was wonderful. And that was almost where I cut my teeth when it came to playing live. So you end up just having a more exaggerated style of playing. And the FNA was, I think, 20 mil. So that was still cool for a five string. That was really nice. Let me see, what are the Dingwalls? I think they're 20 mil. I'm just looking at a Dingwall 4 here. It feels...
Yeah, the 4s are bigger. The 5s are
more
narrow.
It's like it's 20.
It
works for me anyway. So it's works for my exaggerated style.
But that was a bit of a surprise. I didn't expect you to have a Dingwall, actually.
Yeah. I'm really feeling the consistency of the neck. Yeah. The intonation is rock solid, and we've had some gnarly flights recently, and it just really works. I've also got this fantastic LA custom shop from Ibanez it's a 37 normal traditional scale. So great down the bottom and a little bit harsh up the top, But that's really cool because that's Vengé. It's all Vengé, you know, except for body, which is swamp ash, because I decided, let's go with that. But that was really, really good of them to do that a few years back. And it's just got one of those characters that it's wonderful. But there is something about Dingwall. I should really sit down with Sheldon the next time we're in the same town together and go.
You should.
I mean, yeah, dude. There's nothing magic about it, but you've shaped modern metal, or djent and technical metal, or you've somehow been able to adjust your instruments as that developed by being in touch with people like Nolly. I mean, maybe that's the case, you know, maybe it's that he's been very attentive, but I do wonder if we'd have such a bass-driven element to modern progressive rock if we didn't have such a, it's a workhorse, but it's like a Swiss Army knife, you know, it does so many things. I'm really impressed with certainly the free pickup version. I tried a 2 pickup version of the Combustion in the studio, and it was an old one as well, and it just didn't do the same thing. So no. I think I'm looking for a sound that's more like Marcus Miller. So it's kind of the bass is heavier, but the sound is a little more mid range than. Well, again, maybe that's the Flea influence as well. Perhaps there's a punky thing going on there that I'm unaware of.
Yeah. Yeah, because with the three pickup ones, you get the, you know, the two back pickups in like series, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, you get that nice semi-stingray thingy.
Yeah, going. Yeah, definitely. It's a great feel, man. It's just, especially when you take the preamp out, like, okay, this is cool. And I'm hoping to speak to Kerry at Nordstrand and get some of the Big Man splits housed in the Dingwall casing.
Oh, that's clever.
What's his name from Bad Wolves was telling me he's got that.
Kyle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kyle.
That's what he's got. And he was saying, man, do it because you like that pickup and it works. I think he's got an EMG preamp on it, though, which I would probably just not do with. I wouldn't bother with.
You'll not do
it. Because the pickup sounds great on its own.
I've basically had that same idea. I've discussed this with Eric as well. I want to order a custom Dingwall, but I want big rig pickups from Nordstrand in them.
Yeah.
You know, the one with like crooked spacing.
Yes.
Love how they sound. Because I've owned several Dingwalls and I've sold them now because I found that when you push the Dingwall pickups, the FDVs or FD3s, I find that they didn't respond to my dynamics in my playing the way I wanted. Okay. Like, they are very linear when you push them, so they always give the same kind of thing when you push them, I find. And I also found that the longer scale of the B string, although it was intoxicating, I kind of find that I like a 34-inch B string sounds more...
Yeah.
How do you say alive somewhere? It has like the piano long 37-inch. It gets like this, you know, the
gets a very strong gauge string. You're talking about though.
I use the standard Dingwall set, the stainless.
127 or 130 on the.
Oh, it's 127. That's correct.
Yeah.
127's what I can't go any. Wider than that, larger than that, because it's just mud for me personally.
Exactly.
I'd love to be 125, but it's, you know, when you're tuned to A flat, that's not going to work. You know, it's it just flaps too much. That's really interesting. So, did you not find something linear going on with the... Or not linear, sorry. Did you not find there was something weird going on with any Warwicks you ever played? Did you say you played Warwicks?
Yeah, absolutely. I've owned five or six Warwicks, I think.
I don't know the what's going on the onboard preamps, the MEC stuff, but it sounds like there's a compressor built in. There's just something odd about the roll. Not odd, there's something fantastic about the... It's like a soft knee compressor.
Yeah.
That's always there. That's almost like tape. It's really weird. So but I never spoke to anybody at Warwick, and they're never going to say if there's some secret sauce going on there. You know, it's a really interesting idea, though, to have a soft knee, a limiter on the output almost. But anyway, that's me just thinking stupid thoughts.
We have a big inside joke between me and Eric about limiters and pickups. We're not going to go there now.
We're not going to go.
10-year anniversary of Altered State, the record I discovered Tesseract through. How do you feel already going on 10 years on that album?
Well, I feel old. but I was really, really surprised that album has become so... everybody seems to resonate with them, because let's face it, it's apart from the lead single off that album, Nocturne, it is quite proggy, and I'm surprised that it reached beyond the prog sphere, especially because at the time it was definitely labeled as djent. I suspect it might be to do with the vocals. They're extremely palatable, they're extremely well written and performed, so maybe that's why. So I've always been quite interested in the fact that people found such a dense album to be so enjoyable. But I mean, we're a different band now, so I would never say you're gonna get another version of that in future albums. But it was beautiful to do at the time, and I'm really happy that it's something that's in our catalogue. But it was almost like an aberration. A one-off, but quite a beautiful one. So I'm really happy with that.
Amazing.
It's actually one of my Desert Island albums. I think a lot of it has to do with, like, honestly, the first time I heard the record, I figured you had a female vocalist. And as I say that in a good sense, because
Ash has that tone.
When I realized Ash was a male voice performing, that I was like, how the hell does he reach those notes and sing them so cleanly? I think his vocals on that record kind of shapes a lot of the music to my ears.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair. It was a fantastic performance, and he has a very folky tone to his voice that is, in some ways, it's got elements of soul and R&B to it, and that's an unusual quality to have in rock and metal. It's really nice.
So Amos, thank you so much for taking your time.
Thanks.
Talking like, when I reached out to you, we're like, oh, I wonder how much nerdiness I can bring out of myself for a podcast. But you did fine, man.
Excellent. Well, I mean, maybe I just don't appreciate how much of a geek I can be sometimes.
And for those not in the know, who are you, Amos, and what are you doing come September?
These are really good questions.
Who the hell are you?
So, I am Amos Williams, or Moss, however you want to call me, is fine. I am the bass player from Tesseract. And, we're doing things now, so please check those things out. And hopefully those things are enjoyable.
The things we've heard so far from the new album sound amazing. It's going to be great to hear like the entire thing. So really looking forward to that.
Brilliant. That's nice to hear, man.
Yeah.
And on that note, I think this is a good signing off point.
Yeah.
Cool, guys.
Totally is.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate that.
We certainly appreciate you coming on.
Cool.
Oh great, it's another bass podcast.